Hey, it's Doug here, and I wanted to pop in before we got started with the episode here. So number one, I want to let you know about a contest that I'm running. So Camp Fi Rocky Mountain week one for 2025. I have a ticket. I bought a ticket and it sold out very quickly. And then I started thinking about it and I was like, you know what? I would prefer to go to a different week because I've been to week one several times and someone would surely enjoy to go to week one. So I decided to do a giveaway. I checked with Steven. He said it was cool. And the thing is, there are like 4 weeks of Camp Fi Rocky Mountain, and I'm going to end up going to 1.5. I'm actually going to speak at 1.5, but I have this week one ticket that I wanted to give away. So you could head over. There's a link in the description so that you can get to it really easily. But basically, you enter your name and email, you join the email list, and then it's one of those deals where you take some actions, like maybe you subscribe to the podcast, maybe you watch a YouTube video, maybe you subscribe on YouTube. It's very clear what you need to do. But anyway, we'll link up and you can get some of the details. And I give other reasons why I'm actually giving the ticket away. I want to promote the podcast and spread the word, but also someone may enjoy going to week one more than I would because, well, frankly, part of it is meeting new people. And I know a lot of the people that will be at week one. So be sure to check that out. This episode is also brought to you by GhostBed. So thanks a lot to GhostBed. They've been partners for a little while. They actually have new low prices, and then you can save 10% if you use the coupon code MILEHIFI, or you could just go to ghostbed.com/MILEHIFI. We personally have the GhostBed Lux, and that one's a little bit softer. It has maximum cooling potential in there with the special cooling layer. I think they have a patent on that. You could check out some of the other information. The thing is, they have several different mattresses out there. And if you're not sure which one you want, you can take the 3-minute sleep quiz. Additionally, they have bed frames. They have different bundles. They have anything that you need to sleep better. And if you're a hot sleeper like I am, I'm warm all the time. I struggle sometimes when I head to on a trip and I'm in a hotel and they don't have a cool mattress. Airbnbs are particularly rough. A lot of times they'll have like a foam mattress, which just, it builds up the heat and it's like I'm on fire. I kind of lose my mind. But anyway, with the GhostBed Lux mattress, I sleep just fine. So do check it out. Thanks a lot to GhostBed. Again, you can save 10%. And if you need help choosing a mattress, you could take their sleep quiz. It just takes a couple minutes, ask you a few questions. The thing is, you don't have to worry about it. They have a 101 night at home sleep trial, and definitely worth checking out if you're in the market for a mattress or other sleeping accessories. Now let's get to the show. Hey, what's going on? Welcome to the Mile High Five podcast. I'm Doug Cunnington. And today we have my good friend, Brian Feraldi, and we're going to talk about Warren Buffett quotes and just things that we can learn from Warren Buffett. Brian, how's it going today?
Doing great, Doug. Thanks for having me back.
And for people that don't know, you just give like a quick intro, and we've talked several times, so I'll link up to old episodes as well. But yeah, what's your story?
Yep. So I'm a individual stock investor. I've been investing on my own for more than 20 years, very successfully. I love to teach other people how to analyze businesses. So I like to get into the weeds of how companies are run and what makes for a good investment.
Very good. And you have great YouTube channel, lots of other stuff we'll link up. And actually, the inspiration for the episode was a checklist. And it is a checklist that you have for basically things you've learned from Warren Buffett. We'll link up to that if people want to check it out as well. Now, when I was researching, I Googled this and I actually ended up on Jimmy Buffett quotes, the great artist. So my quotes are going to be a little bit off, but I'm going to kick it off with, if life gives you limes, make margaritas. I think that's great. So, and I'm just kidding, of course, I didn't do that poor of research, but we have a great checklist here. And Brian, will you kick it off? What's one of your favorite items here on the list?
So Warren Buffett is an investor that every individual investor should study thoroughly, even if you don't emulate his exact style. He is a value investor. He buys businesses that have been in operations for a long period of time. They're gushing cash. They're profitable. They have a moat, and he buys them at a discount. That is one way to invest. That's not the only way to invest. But even if you are a type of investor that does not invest that way, it's really worthwhile to understand his criteria, because it has lasted for 70 plus years, and it has consistently generated strong returns from investors. You can learn a lot about how to invest the right way by studying his style. So I'll start with just the first item on this checklist is probably my favorite, and something that so many investors skip over when they're buying a stock, and that is the business understandable? There are so many companies out there that are really hard to understand what they are, how they work, and how they make money. One of the most popular stocks on the stock market today is a company called Palantir, PLTR. It is a meme, it is a cult stock. There are people that love Palantir, the company. I would challenge almost any of them to say, what does the company do? And how does it do it? It's a very hard business to understand. So Buffett's number one item on the checklist is, do I understand it? And if I don't, nothing else matters. Pass.
And you just move on. Very good. Do you have any like counterexamples? And this question may go nowhere where, and we'll get into it more, but I want to keep this in mind as we're going through, like sort of misuse of some of these items, right? So sometimes we hear something and then someone takes it to the extreme. So I don't know if it applies here, and if not, then we can move on. But yeah, are there any sort of like counter examples that you could think of where, you know, you've heard someone say, I don't understand it, but it turns out it wasn't that complicated of a business and they just didn't do their research?
Or I would say there are plenty of examples of people not knowing what they're buying. They buy it and they do well because they just got lucky, or they got some macro thing about the business correct, like the market grew a lot, even if they didn't necessarily understand the underlying stock. So you can buy stocks, do zero research on them, not understand the business, and make money. That is entirely possible to happen. But that's not really investing. That's more gambling, in my opinion.
Right. Okay. What's next? What's your sort of second favorite, I guess?
Does the company have favorable long-term prospects? Is this a business, even if a company is doing well today, when you become a part owner of that company, all of the value that's going to accrue to you as the buyer of that business is going to be what the company does in the future. So all of the results that we have from the company, all the data that we have in the company is about its past history. But all the returns we're going to generate is going to be based on what the company does from the moment you buy it to into the future. So you have to have a good sense of, does this company have favorable long-term prospects? Are there reasons to believe that revenue and profits can continue to grow, that the company has some type of competitive advantage associated with it, and that you think the history that the company has generated thus far will continue into the future? If you don't think the company has favorable long-term prospects, again, it should be a company you just pass on.
Got it. So how do you analyze this deeper? So sounds good. We have the value investing mindset. We're thinking long-term. How do you double check this and make sure you're making a good decision?
There's a bunch of ways that you can do it. There's shorthanded ways, and then there's long-handed ways. First off, if a company, the market that a company operates in can have a huge impact on the company's performance. If you were in the AI business right now, right? That's the buzz market of the day. You can be pretty, I'm very confident that the market for AI products is going to be significantly larger 3 years, 5 years, 10 years from now than it is today. Now, just because a company is in AI and the market is growing doesn't mean that that company is going to do well. You can make a reasonable assumption that the market for AI is going to grow into the future. Conversely, if you were in the newspaper business, right, the print newspaper business, I think it's reasonable to assume that the future prospects of that entire industry are quite bleak. And 10 years from now, I have a really hard time believing that there's going to be more newspaper subscribers than there are today. So depending on what business the company operates in, you can make some reasonable assumptions about the future potential of the market in general and the company's competitive position in that market. That's the hard way of doing it and thinking about it. The easy way to do it is just to go look at analyst estimates. So many companies have analysts that follow them and they put out reports believing what the company's revenue and profits are going to be over the next couple of years. If you generally see the trend of up and growth, and the company has already demonstrated a history of growing, it's not that hard to come up with a thesis for why a company can continue to grow.
And I'll jump to one of these others, which is somewhat related as far as like the market overall. And that is it a business that even a dummy could make money in? And it's like, yeah, if you're in a growing market, you could probably make a lot of mistakes, some poor decisions, maybe not the greatest product, and you're going to be okay. Because, for example, AI is growing so much, and I have my sort of other world that I'm in where it's sort of SEO and marketing related. I definitely saw several people create AI tools early on that were maybe kind of okay, but they were very early and they sold, they made some money on it. And I'm pretty sure those products are like now baked into ChatGPT or Gemini or Claude or whichever tool is out there. Like it's just in there. And that tool is completely irrelevant. And it was very irrelevant within like weeks. Not that the founders were dummies or anything, but they were just there at the right time. And perhaps a dummy could have just like accidentally done a really good job.
Well, Buffett, when you talk about that quote, he's specifically talking about businesses could be that do not require a superstar CEO in order to do well. As a quick example, if you made me the CEO of Visa, I could not show up for work, make no decisions, and that business would do just fine. It is so ingrained into people's lives. It is so ridiculously profitable, and it has tentacles everywhere in the world that me being a dummy CEO, a know nothing, could still do well running that business because that business is so well set up for a success into the future. You could not say the same thing if you made me the CEO of Tesla. The amount of knowledge and requirements and good decisions that you have to make as the CEO of a fast-growing, emerging company are just radically higher than they are for one that's established and then one that dummy can run. Now, again, Buffett's investing style is to buy businesses that dummies can run. Any dummy can run Coca-Cola or Visa or the railroad companies because the businesses themselves have intrinsic characteristics that are very, very attractive that they don't require managerial brilliance in order to operate them well. So I think that that's the angle that he's going for when it comes to that checkmark.
All right. Moving on. What's another one that you really enjoy?
Well, a major category for Buffett is essentially he starts by looking at the business. What do I understand the business? Does it have favorable characteristics? Do I think it has good long-term growth prospects? And his next check is then to see, well, who is the person that's running the business? And he focuses a lot on the management team. And I love some of the questions that he asks about the company. He's like, he doesn't care where you went to school. He doesn't care about any of like your credentials or anything like that. He wants to know, does the management team demonstrate integrity? Does the management team demonstrate intelligence? And the way that you check that is by reading the filings that they put in their annual report. How do they communicate to their shareholders, to their co-owners of the business? Do they speak in plain and simple language, or do they try and confuse you with complicated terms? Are they forthcoming and do they admit mistakes, or do they just give you a glitzy brochure of how wonderful they are? Are they rational and are they candid with what they're doing, or are they trying to take advantage of opportunities almost like sporadically? And are they trying to diversify the business? So after Buffett is interested in the business, he then checks the management team to say, is this somebody I want to trust with my capital?
Very good. That makes sense. What else around management?
Well, a big thing that Buffett and Munger, his partner, talked about for a long time is incentives. You have to get the incentives right because people respond to incentives. So many times, compensation structures are not set up well, and a CEO or management team is going to act in behalf of their incentive. So if they have a dumb compensation structure, you are going to get dumb outcomes because you're paying those people to do things that might not be aligned with you. For example, Buffett and Munger have railed against the use of stock options and stock-based compensation for decades now. They do not pay any sort of stock-based compensation at all to employees of Berkshire Hathaway. Buffett has said instead that he uses cash bonuses tied to that particular manager's individual performance to reward them for doing a good job or not. He thinks that that eliminates a lot of conflict in interest and directly ties their performance to the money that they receive. That is very different thinking than a lot of companies that exist today. Over the last 20 plus years, a lot of newer companies basically dole out stock options and stock-based compensation like it's candy, like it's free candy that they're giving away. But Buffett has a big check on, is the compensation that the CEO is receiving or the management team is receiving directly tied to the performance of the business and it's not in stock. If they do that, that's a big check for Buffett.
Got it. So, you know, as we're going through here, there's many things that Buffett would check. Sometimes I suspect a company doesn't pass everything, right? So there's a spectrum, right? So maybe management changes or there something is a little bit different. Can you think of any examples where he's maybe not held as firmly to some of the items that we have listed here and made maybe a different decision? Or is he so strict on these that if it doesn't hit everything, he won't make that investment?
So Buffett, if you look at what he has said or some quotes that people directly attribute to him, they people always point out that Buffett is a buy and hold forever type of investment. Because one of his favorite quotes is, if we own outstanding businesses with outstanding management, our favorite holding period is forever. People believe that to think that Warren Buffett is the type of investor that buys a stock and then never sells it, never thinks about it again. That's not true. If you actually look back at Buffett's portfolio, at least his public portfolio, not the company he buys for Berkshire Hathaway, but the publicly traded stock that he owns, he actually has a fairly rapid trading period, far slower than most people on Wall Street. But Buffett has sometimes bought stock and then sold those same stocks months or years later, sometimes within a very short period, just within the last year or so. Buffett took a big position in a company called Ulta Beauty, a beauty retailer that's largely in the United States. And then within a couple of months, he actually sold all of that position. So I think there are some criteria that when Buffett looks at that he absolutely will not pass on. He won't make any investment unless he understands what it is. He won't make any investment unless he understands the characteristics of the business. And it's one that even, quote unquote, a dummy could run. But there are plenty of cases when Buffett's analysis of the core operations were incorrect. He assumed that the company had favorable long-term growth prospects, but after he buys it, new information comes in and he's like, maybe this company doesn't. Maybe I overestimated the company's competitive advantage. Maybe I overestimated the company's long-term growth prospects. Maybe I overpaid for this stock. In those times, he has been proven very willing to cut bait and sell those stocks and use them to buy other businesses. Like a decade ago, one of Buffett's top positions in his company, I think it was like number two or number three, was IBM. All over the news, Buffett buys IBM, makes a massive bet on IBM. And they essentially held IBM for 8 years or something, somewhere along that time frame. And Buffett was wrong, flat out wrong on IBM. IBM stock basically went down and ultimately it ended up trading sideways. Buffett, it took him years, but he later admitted mistakes, sold everything, all of his IBM stock, and then he used it to buy Apple. And then Apple went on to essentially 5x or more in value with him over the course of a decade. So that was an example of him going through this checklist, realizing over a course of years, the company did not have favorable long-term growth prospects, admitted his mistake, selling it, and then buying something better.
Got it. So for you, Brian, if you're willing, able to share, surely you have been in a position where you were like, you know what, I misinterpreted just like you described. How do you unravel that? Did you struggle with it? Are you able to overlook the sunk cost and make the decision from that point in time. And I'll just kind of leave it open however you want to tell the story, or we could punt it if we need to.
No, that's fine. I'm more than happy to talk about my mistakes. And boy, do I have plenty of it. If you could make a stock investing mistake, I have made it. And I have lost money on dozens and dozens of companies. And that's just how stock investing works. That's the exact same way that index fund investing works, by the way. It's just that all the chaos and all the losses that you have are hidden from your view. But I have bought plenty of companies over the years where I overestimated the company's growth potential, where I overestimated the company's valuation, where I thought the company had a competitive advantage, but it didn't. Let me give you one that comes to mind immediately. About 6 years ago, Grubhub was a publicly traded company. Grubhub was essentially one of the pioneers of, we will deliver food to your house from these restaurants that don't normally offer delivery. They were a great brand name. They were founder-led. They were profitable. They were growing like 30% per year, and they were the top dog in the space. Yes, there was lots of other competitors in the space, but Grubhub was far and away number one. I bought them under the assumption that the company had a long-term competitive advantage because I figured that buyers wanted to go to the platform with the most restaurants, and restaurants wanted to be on the platform with the most buyers. And I thought that gave Grubhub a strong competitive advantage. I was wrong, flat out wrong about Grubhub, because DoorDash came along and DoorDash wiped the floor with all other delivery apps that were out there. I honestly don't know what made DoorDash that much better than Grubhub. To me, I wasn't a user, so I didn't really see the advantage of DoorDash versus other, but I do know that DoorDash came in and effectively wiped the floor with Grubhub. And Grubhub eventually I got bought out at a far lower price than I bought in, but they effectively admitted defeat, and they might have been bought by DoorDash, but that market got extremely consolidated to the point that today it's effectively a two-horse race between DoorDash and Uber Eats. Like, those two companies weren't even on my radar, and they ended up winning the market. But that was a case when, by looking at the company's financial statements, you could clearly tell that growth was slowing, that competitors were coming in and they were crushing the company's margins. And then when they eventually got sold, it was just obvious that my initial thesis running that company was wrong.
When, or did you sell and get out of your position, or were they acquired and merged and then?
I believe I held until they were acquired, and then I sold the shares. What I've learned about myself as an investor is that I am good at analyzing companies and getting them into my portfolio, but my track record with selling and getting them out of my portfolio is worse. And the worst mistake that you can make as an individual stock investor, the worst mistake, is to buy a great business and then sell that business way too early. So when I've analyzed all the losers that I've ever had, all of them, take all the losses that I've ever had from all the losers, which is plenty, and it's cost me tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars. All those losses are irrelevant when you compare it to the fact that I bought Netflix 15 years ago and didn't sell it. So the gains that I've had on my Netflix position have paid for every loss that I've ever had combined. And all I did was buy Netflix and then not sell it, even though there were numerous times in Netflix's history when the obvious, and I put that in air quotes, the obvious thing to do was to sell Netflix. So that's what you have to be able to do if you are an individual stock investor. So even if I got every sell decision correct, if I sold Netflix 10 years ago, it would have been all my sell decisions combined would have been wrong. So knowing that, I focus all of my energy on buying stocks and getting them into my portfolio. And then once they're in there, I am extremely reluctant to sell them, even if it becomes obvious that I was wrong. Because even if I get 9 out of 10 sell decisions right, if I sell the next Netflix too early, or I sell the next Amazon too early, all the good decisions won't matter.
Got it. That's so interesting. So it's very much, you know, an asymmetric upside. And because you do so well in the due diligence and selecting what makes it into your portfolio, you're pretty confident, like the downside is sort of capped. Is that a decent interpretation?
Yeah, of what you're totally. Okay. The worst you can do on a stock without leverage is minus 100%. That's the worst that you can do. The best you can do on a stock is plus 1,000,000%. Even Munger has recently admitted that. I saw an interview and Munger said, What is your sell process? What is your sell discipline? And he says, my sell discipline is to never, is to buy companies that I don't ever have to think about selling them. Like Munger's, all of Munger's fortunes were in just a handful of companies, Berkshire Hathaway and Costco, number one, number two, by far his biggest positions. And he said, what's my exit strategy for those companies? Death. Death is my exit strategy, effectively. Sure. And he was right. And he has been right so far on both of those companies. So even if Munger, who is far smarter than me, says, I devote all my time to finding the great businesses, not selling the ones that are in my portfolio, I have a hard time improving upon that process.
That's great. That's a great way to look at it. Okay, so we're going to go through just a couple more here, and then we'll transition to market volatility. So at the time that we're actually recording this, it's April of 2025. So I didn't want to do a whole episode on volatility. We'll try to keep it on sort of evergreen lessons that we can learn. And we'll talk about a couple other things too. But Brian, what are a couple others that we should mention before we finish up with this checklist?
Final check that Buffett always looks at is just a financial check. So you can have a good business with a good management team, but if the business and the management team don't result in good financial results, you won't have found a good company. When it comes to doing financial check, one metric that Buffett always looks at is something called return on equity. The formula here is very simple. It's net income in the numerator, so how much profit the company made over the last year, divided by shareholders' equity. Shareholders' equity is found in the balance sheet, and it's a term that roughly means how much capital has been put by shareholders into the business. Buffett wants to see that this number is over 15%. Think of that kind of like the interest rate that the business pays on the money that's been put into it. Like if you went to a bank and put your money into a bank account, and that bank account paid 15% interest, that would be a pretty good return. So Buffett looks for businesses that have a high return on equity, businesses that can compound shareholder capital for them, because that is what drives really good, solid, long-term returns. So, and importantly, doing so without relying a lot on debt, because the more debt that you put into the business, you can actually juice that number to be artificially high. So companies that return great returns on equity with minimal or no debt. If you can find a company that does that combination of things, you have found a good business.
All right. Any other thoughts on the checklist, points from Buffett, et cetera?
I'm a huge fan of checklists in general. Buffett has his checklist. Munger has his checklist. Checklists are truly a cheat code when it comes to breaking down complex topics. So even if you don't invest like Buffett, which is perfectly fine, I don't invest like Buffett, I think it's worth the while to develop an investing checklist for yourself. Just having a checklist of something that you write down on a piece of paper where you're thinking when you're calm and rational and what truly matters to you, that information will be priceless to you after you make a buy decision, because it is really hard to make a buy decision without a process in place, or at least a good buy decision without a process in place. So if Munger is an advocate of checklists and Buffett is an advocate of checklists, again, they're two of the most successful investors ever. So if they need it to invest well, just use it.
Got it. Okay. So you seem like the kind of dude that reads the annual reports from Berkshire Hathaway. Is that true?
Yep.
There are many of them out there, of course. How should or could someone approach them if they want to take a look at them, but they don't want to be overwhelmed? Do you have any suggestions on that?
Yeah, there's books out there that summarize them for you, or you can use AI. There's something called Buffett Bot. If you search Google for Buffett Bot AI, ask questions to Buffett Bot, and it will go through and read all the annual reports and show you things that Buffett has said about them. A book just came out a couple of weeks ago called Warren Buffett and Munger Unscripted, or Berkshire Hathaway Unscripted. I bought it, and it's effectively, somebody went through all of the transcripts to every shareholder meeting that they've ever done, categorize their best quotes and then put them into categories by thinking about a business, valuation, macroeconomics, analyst results, etc. So if you just want their views on a specific topic, that can be a great way to do it. But we are truly spoiled nowadays. It's never been easier to get answers to these kind of things. So if you're hardcore, read every single one. They are literally worth your time to do so. If you're not feeling hardcore, use tools and shortcuts that other people have created.
Got it. Well, and it sounds like, I mean, you like it so much that you read the original like transcripts and reports and everything, but then you will buy a book if it comes out to have it sort of consolidated, summarized, slash, I guess, just easier to find certain topics. So what is the value for you to go back to the original, like the longer form, non-summary versions of it?
Well, it's all about what your personal learning style is. I actually learn best in two ways, audio and then reading. So I actually like learning the most from podcasts because that fits my learning style. I learn best when I'm listening to something, thinking about that thing, but my body is in motion. So I'm doing yard work or cleaning up or on the walk or something like that. And thankfully, podcasts are a godsend from that because you can learn basically anything for free by using those. And I would surmise, I don't know this for sure, but I would surmise there are ways that you can access their talks in podcast form. But some other people learn best by sitting down and reading long form. And that's been, you know, historically a fantastic way to learn. But I'm still a big fan of going back to the original documents and reading the original documents. And if you have to do it piecemeal, so be it.
Got it. Okay. And last question here. So sometimes people misuse like a checklist like this or information, like they hold on to a specific quote and maybe they don't know the context of the quote and then they misuse it. I'm curious, have you seen people misuse advice from maybe the annual reports, from Buffett, from Munger, that sort of thing?
Of course. As we talked about previously, people assume that Warren Buffett is a buy and hold forever type of investor. He's not. That is a quote that he had that people focused in on one little bit of it, and then they summarize that into his whole investing philosophy. That's not what he does. So any quote that come out there that people have said could be misinterpreted. I mean, Doug, you're a creator. I'm a creator. Things that I've tweeted out or things that I've said, people misconstrue and people put back in my face. Like, oh, you said this thing. As if the ability to change your mind as new information comes in is a weakness. Buffett and Munger, their thinking on investing is constantly evolving. So something that I said in 1970 might not be the same thing that they feel and act today. But if you're a content creator, Doug, like both of us are, that's just the cost of doing business.
Yeah, I've said all sorts of crazy things that I don't even know why I said them. So, all right. Brian, this is so fun to catch up. I mentioned that people could find the checklist. Where should they go if they want to get the full checklist here? Yeah, it's a PDF, so they can get it easy. Where do they go?
Yep. So I have it free on my website. It's just longtermmindset.co. My company's called Long Term Mindset, /Buffett, B-U-F-F-E-T-T. If you could put a link in the video or the podcast, that would be great. But if you click that, I do have a PDF that has Warren Buffett's checklist. It's completely free to download.
Very good. Yeah, we'll link up to that. And what else do you have going on, say the rest of the year, that sort of thing, if people want to keep up with you?
I'm a content creator, right? So I'm on essentially every platform. The only platform I'm not on, ironically, is podcasts, even though that's my favorite way to learn. But Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, I'm constantly creating content on all of those. But a big focus for me the rest of the year is going to be YouTube and long form videos on evergreen topics like this. So if that kind of thing interests you, my YouTube channel is called Long Term Mindset.
Perfect. Yeah, we'll link up to that and all the other places too. It's a great channel. You have great energy, tons of information. It's always fun to chat with you. So thanks a lot, Brian, and we'll talk again soon. Thanks for listening to the show. That was the Mile High Five podcast, and I'm Doug Cunnington. If you dig the show, please do three things for us. Number one, tell a friend, a family member, an enemy about the show. We really don't care who you tell. Maybe forward them a specific show that you know that they will like. It's the single most helpful thing that you can do to spread the word. It's like giving us a virtual high five, and actually we don't give high fives in person, so the virtual kind's pretty good. And more importantly, your friend or family member or even your enemy will appreciate the fact that you were thinking of them. Number two, make sure you're following or subscribed on your podcast app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Overcast, YouTube, whatever you're using, and that way you won't miss a show. And number three, please leave us a rating and review. We read them on the show occasionally, and you might hear yours out there on an upcoming episode. Quick disclaimer, this show is not financial or legal advice. I'd actually be surprised if it sounded like it. It's really just for entertainment, and that's at least what we're hoping for. But seriously, get advice from professionals. So we'll catch y'all next week. All right, so Brian, it's good to catch up with you. So this is the sound check. We will play it at the end. And you just got back from vacation. Where did you go? What did you do? What were some highlights?
Went to Puerto Rico for a week. So me, my family, there's five of us, went with three other families, foursome, a threesome, and a twosome. So there are 14 of us in total. And we went to Puerto Rico, never been there before. And we went all the way to the West Coast. So San Juan, the big city there, is on the East Coast. And when we got there, we drove basically 2 hours due west, complete opposite side of the island. And it was very chill there, very relaxed, did not have a super touristy vibe, much more local people, but great food. Everyone in my family likes snorkeling. So we got to go snorkeling. We got to snorkel with, we saw sea turtles. We saw stingray. We saw nurse sharks. And we were just at this four-story house with this big pool. Everybody that went on this trip got along, and it was a great time.
Had you traveled with that group of people all together before?
Not that specific group. One other family, two other families we've been on vacation with before. And then it was the sister and brother of one of my friends. They're empty nesters, so they came along, just wanted to do stuff with us. But very important when you go on vacation with people that everybody gets along with everybody. So picking the right people to go on vacation on is key. And we had that box checked.
Got it. Okay. Yeah. That's what I was like, oh man, there's a lot of personalities in there. And then the other part is like, do you often do like everything together, or people can split up and like some people want more alone time, or some people want to do things in small groups. So is it pretty open, like whatever anyone wants to do?
I don't know if you're a fan of Fight Club at all, but I always think of Fight Club and the Project Mayhem, which was you choose your own level of involvement. I always go back to that quote in my mind. So it is, here is the thing that the group is doing. Join if you want to. And if you don't join, do your own thing. Come, don't come, whatever. This is what some of us are doing. You're welcome to come, but you don't have to. So we try and keep it as open. And that includes our kids, right? We're like, this is what we're doing. We suggest you do it, but you don't have to. And that even just that choice of opting out goes a long way.
Very good. The other thing, well, I'm always thinking about food for trips, very important. And actually, like, I like to cook a lot. And it sounds like you had a house. How did you handle the food, especially for that number of people? And yeah, how did you manage that?
Yep, it is tricky. So we went grocery shopping a few different times. You kind of pool the receipts together at the end, and then you just divide by each person's share. So that's how you split the costs. But you go with the things that most people are going to like most of the time. So tacos, spaghetti, breakfast food, and stuff like that. We always had in the house snacks, deli meat, that kind of stuff. And then we went out together to dinner a couple of times. And when you do that, everyone's just responsible for their own bill. So yeah, those are absolutely the things you have to kind of think about and plan ahead of time. But as long as everyone's on the same page about what's happening, it can go pretty smoothly.
Yeah. Not too bad. It is so interesting. Like I went on a trip, I guess it was last summer. My sisters and their families came out. So we knew everybody gets along, although they had some young kids. So they're volatile. So they're volatile sometimes in a good way, but everything worked out fine. But I'm always, I take care of the food here. So I'm always thinking like, how much do we need? And all of a sudden we go from two people to, I don't even remember how many people is that. Anyway, over 10, right? So there's a handful of folks and I'm like, okay, we'll all go to the store together. We'll get some stuff. We mostly eat okay. And then we do some signups and all that stuff to make sure everybody knows when they're cooking and like how much food. But I just think about food all the time. That's my thing. Mm-hmm. So, all right.
Awesome. It's a critical part of vacation.
Yeah. And I get grouchy. So yeah, just got to make sure I'm fed and there's snack foods or whatever. Yep. So, all right.